Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hi, this is Carl Alvarez from the Inside Metal Series producer, and you are listening to Mark on Talking Metal.
Welcome to another edition of the Talking Metal Podcast, home of all things hard rock and heavy metal. I'm Mark Striegel, host and producer of this show since 2005. Now, let's get things started with the Talking Metal theme song, written by Rob Halford, Metal Mike, and Roy Z.
Hey guys, welcome back to another edition of Talking Metal. Happy New Year. It is the first podcast of 2017. And I had a little time off. I was on vacation with the family, out visiting the in-laws in Indiana, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Then I was on jury duty for a while when I got back. So it's been a little hectic, and I apologize for the lack of podcasts. But here we are, and hopefully back on schedule with podcasts hitting every Tuesday, and we are in 2017. Today's guest is Carl. He is one of the producers on the Inside Metal documentary, which is great. They've done two episodes of it over the past couple of years. They're doing more. He'll tell us a little bit about the next one that's coming out, episode 3. But episode 2, if you're into the LA metal scene like I was when I was growing up and still into it, it's a must-watch, guys. It's so good. They did a great job with this, and it's Inside Metal, and it's available to watch on Amazon. We'll also have the DVD link through today's show notes on TalkingMetal.com. And again, the second edition of it is called The LA Metal Scene Explodes. It's on Amazon Prime. If you do like streaming TV and you watch Amazon, you can check it out there. You can also, like I said, order the DVD by going to TalkingMetal.com and checking in with the show notes for today's episode. Before we get into talking about LA Metal and doing some LA Metal music, listening to some LA Metal music from back in the day, let me just cover a few things. You know, I just want to reiterate, I've said this before, but this podcast sounds so much better if you get it through iTunes as opposed to listening to it on Spreaker. Spreaker is a platform that I pay to use. Sometimes I wonder why I'm paying for it there. I guess specifically because they have these embedded players, and some of the blogs like the embedded player, but the bottom line is that they crunch the file when I submit it to them and they make it sound bad. So music to me, whenever I listen to it on the Spreaker player, doesn't sound that great. So if you're somebody who listens to this show for the music, as well as the interviews and the chat, I suggest going to iTunes and subscribing to it there and just downloading it that way. It sounds so much better. It boggles my mind why people even just do, interview-based shows with no music, post their files as mono on iTunes. Eddie Trunk, for example. I mean, even that like little intro music he has, it sounds so bad. Why wouldn't you do it as a stereo file? Maybe that's a podcast one thing. I don't know, because I noticed Tom Arnold's podcast does the same thing. So we are, again, going to address some listener voicemails that we got. Please call me and leave your voicemails. The number is 973-757-1917. Again, the number to leave a voicemail, 973-757-1917. If you leave a voicemail, I most likely will play it on the show. I did accidentally delete one of them that came in over the past week, so sorry about that. Call me again if you don't hear your voicemail in this episode. Leave another voicemail. I will play that. So, yeah, we're going to get right into these voicemails. Just please remember to write a review for us on iTunes. In the iTunes store, go write a review for Talking Metal, preferably a positive one. Follow me on Twitter. The Talking Metal account that I run is at Talking Metal. And then I have my solo account at Striegel, which is Strigl. I don't, and then I have, the solo account, the Striegel account. Is, no pun intended because I said solo, is more like Star Wars stuff than Talking Metal, but yeah, you get it. And Talking Metal on Instagram, you can do that. I'm on Snapchat, Captain T-Head. All this stuff is listed in today's show notes on TalkingMetal.com. So, cool. Call the hotline, write us a review, use our Amazon links. That's how you support what we do here, or you can give a PayPal donation. Just simply like our Facebook page, whatever the fuck you want to do. You know how it goes. All right, here we go. Voicemails from you guys. Let me pull these up.
Hey, Mark, it's Matt up in Rochester. What's going on?
Hey, Matt.
Hey, yeah, man, I just wanted to let you know I'm listening. Obviously a long-time listener, and
cool.
Wanted to comment on a couple things you brought up recently on the show. As much as I've been listening to you guys for a super long time, since the early days,
right.
John was great and liked the dynamic you guys had, but quite honestly, it's been your show for a while now. So, that is Talking Metal. That's where the future is. So,
thank you.
You know, we all want you to keep it up and keep it moving. So what you're doing has been great, and looking forward to more interviews and new stuff for the next year. And, Emily's been doing some great interviews as well. Just want to add that, and looking forward to more of those in 2017. And hey, I just wanted to see what you thought about the new Star Wars. Opening weekend. In my opinion, Star Wars could do no wrong. I loved it. Anyways, just want to see what your opinion on that was. And if you get a chance, you want to play a new tune, there's a cool band called DGM. There's a tune called Fallen that's really cool. Check it out. All right, man. Happy New Year, and I'll talk to you later. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Matt, and good to hear from you again. I know we've been in contact before. Always great to hear from the longtime listeners. So let me just, I don't know DGM. Hold on. Let me just see if I can find that on iTunes. Okay, Matt, I'm looking for DGM. The song Balm, B-A-L-M, or was it Bomb? I'm not seeing this group on iTunes. So send me a little more information. Hit me up on Facebook or Twitter, or mark@talkingmetal.com is the email, and I will try to get that on for you on a future episode. I'm very sorry. Can't find it. Maybe I'm misunderstanding what you're saying. Anyways, yeah.
You're right, man. I mean, it's like, you know, the show's been mine for a while. Thank you for saying that. And I feel very fortunate to have the one and only Mitch LaFon working with me, because he's really been a breath of fresh air, somebody who works so hard. And, you know, John in the beginning was really into it. I don't think he has a passion for it anymore, even though he says he does when he comes on the show. But, you know, he's got a band, he's reformed, and he's got a girlfriend. He's got a lot of Ace. He's got a real job at Nickelodeon. So he's got a lot of stuff on his plate. And obviously, the priorities for someone in their life always rise to the top. And it's, you know, after 14 months of not doing the show at all, and then what, doing, I don't know how many shows he did in 2016. I mean, it can't be more than 8, right? I don't know. I mean, it's hard for me to think that talking metal is a priority for him anymore. So, which is fine. Listen, I get it. I get it. Like I said, but I'm moving forward with this, and I really in 2017 want to take this up a notch. Mitch and I are talking about how that could happen. So, stick with us and go visit the website. That's a really important thing you can do. If you don't give PayPal donations, you don't use the Amazon links, you don't do anything, one thing you can do is visit our website. I'd appreciate that. And Mitch is posting news. We're breaking news on there. We're posting stuff that, you know, we used to send over to Blabbermouth to try to get them to pick it up. We're not really doing that anymore. We're just going to, if Blabbermouth discovers something we put on our site, which they have since we stopped sending them press releases, so be it. But we want to be kind of like what Metal Sucks is and what Metal Injection is, a place, a destination that you can guys can go to, not just a blog that, you know, is kind of secondary to our podcast. We want the podcast to be just one element of what Talking Metal Digital is. And that's my, and when I say the podcast, I mean the podcasts, plural, Mitch's podcast, my podcast, Metal Raps. So yeah, so check out Talking Metal Digital on a regular basis, talkingmetal.com or talkingmetaldigital.com. That's a good thing you can do. And what else did you say? Oh, Matt, you said about Star Wars, right? Rogue One. I've become, my whole life, I've been a big Star Wars fan, but I've become more obsessive with it in recent years. And I thought, you know, I've had a lot of discussions with a lot of different people about Rogue One, but I went opening night. I didn't go to like the Thursday night showing. I went to the Friday night showing after work, which was tough. I was just avoiding the internet all day because I didn't want to hear anything. So I went in pretty without many spoilers or anything, without reading any reviews, and I was blown away. I thought Rogue One was excellent. In some ways, it was easier for me to watch than watching The Force Awakens was for the first time, because my expectations were so high, and I just thought Rogue One reminded me of like a Star Wars novel brought to life. You know, it wasn't about those main characters, although we had some of them creep in with Darth Vader and, you know, R2-D2, C-3PO, Cameo, and Princess Leia. And, you know, I thought it was excellent. Excellent. And I hear so many people mention the last 45 minutes as being excellent. I thought the whole thing was excellent. And I get it that people who only want to see Chewbacca or something like that maybe aren't into it as much. But this was a powerful movie. This was really, really well done. And the other, I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were like, well, the technology in there is so stupid. Why'd they have to climb the tower to do that? Dudes, this is a fantasy movie. This isn't reality. It's like saying, why is the dragon so big why are the dragons so big in Game of Thrones? The lizards don't grow that big. You know, it's fucking stupid, man. This is completely fantasy. Their technology isn't, you can't compare it to our technology here on Earth. It's Star Wars. It's a fantasy. It has nothing to do with reality. If you want a movie that has something that's real, or mimics reality, go watch one of those movies. This is complete. It's Star Wars. It's complete, utter fantasy nonsense. So you got guys, you know, raising objects and using the Force and stuff. Don't talk to me about, well, the computer technology that they were showing was unrealistic. The whole thing is unrealistic. So it fucking pisses me off when I hear people cut down Star Wars because it scientifically is not accurate. Of course it's not. It's completely fake. And it's the best fucking fantasy story ever, period. I loved Rogue One, Matt. Great, great stuff. And was just so happy. I took my kids back to see it when I was on vacation out in Indiana visiting the in-laws and enjoyed it again the second time. I haven't seen it in 3D. I kind of like to go see it in 3D. Both the viewings I saw were, you know, 2D, and it looks great. I'm not a big fan of 3D, but I would at least like to see it in 3D before it's pulled out of the theater. Ben Mendelsohn, such a great actor. He plays Director Krennic. I thought that was just incredible. Tarkin, I just read the Tarkin novel, which I highly recommend. Very, very good novel that has a lot of stuff that kind of helps set up Rogue One. There's another novel now that's even closer to Rogue One. Ben Mendelsohn, I'm just going off on a tangent here. Such a good actor. Loved him in Bloodline and loved him in Rogue One. Forrest Whitaker, one of my all-time favorite actors, Saw Gerrera, did an excellent job. And really some good talent in this movie, including not just in front of the camera, but behind the camera. So that's that. All right, let's get to another one of these. Matt, thanks so much for your call, and please keep in touch. Let me know what that group was that I can't figure out, and I'll get it on a future podcast for you. Guys, stay tuned for our interview and discussion on LA Metal coming up just in a little bit. Let's get to the next call. Here we go.
Hiya, Mark. This is Pete from South Wales.
Pete.
I love the podcast, and I've been listening for 8 years now. Yeah. For some reason, enough's enough. Sort of passed me by. I didn't know any of the albums, didn't know any of the songs, didn't know anything about them, to be honest. I listened to your interview with Chips It Off, and I became hooked. I love the band now. I'm an absolute bloody addict. Got most of their albums now, and just got Claims Lounge, and I'm loving it.
Cool.
My question is, any chance of getting an interview with Donny V?
That'd be great.
And if not, just play some Enough's Enough for me. Cheers, Matt. Keep up the good work.
Pete, it's great to hear from you. I know you from Facebook, and you know, people have told me that they feel like I'm a friend because they listen to the podcast on a regular basis, even though we technically don't know each other. And a guy like Pete, I feel like he's a friend because he somehow connected with me on Facebook. He's a regular listener to the podcast. I you know, see pictures of him doing stuff. I always get a kick out of his posts, whether it's him talking about drinking and listening to some music or seeing pictures of his son or your daughter. You have two beautiful children, Pete. And it's great to hear from you. I love hearing your voice for the first time. So thank you for making the long distance call across the pond here to the United States of America. Always great to hear from you. I'd love to speak with Donny V. That is, it's interesting. I Chip in interviews has put on a good face and makes it sound like he and Donny V are still cool, good buds, friends. At least that's the vibe I've gotten from the interviews we've done with him and the interviews I've heard with him, although I don't know that he's ever said that, but I can't help wondering if their relationship is a bit strained now, being that Chip has continued the band on without Donny V. I don't know. Maybe it's not. That's just speculation on my part. I should probably ask Chip the next time he's on the show, but, I would love to talk with Donny V. I don't even know how to get in contact with him, but maybe I'll have to, search him out and invite him on Talking Metal at some point. And we will definitely get some Enough's Enough on for you right now. Let's just go with some classic shit here. This is Taking a Ride by Enough's Enough. Going over to Pete over in the UK. All right, a little Enough's Enough here on Talking Metal for Pete. Good to hear from you, man. Thanks for calling in. Let's get to the next call right here. This guy doesn't identify himself, but he is Jeff.
Hey, Mark. I don't know what that chick from Alabama did to your website, but it takes forever to load. Check out talkingmetal.com. The load times are, I don't know, about 30 seconds, and then it comes up, and then it's you can click around. It's okay, but check it out. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for calling. I'm assuming this is Jeff because you sent me a massive PayPal donation, and also in that PayPal donation note, you mentioned about this website problem, and this voicemail came in right at the same time. So, A, wow. All I can say about that PayPal donation is, wow, thank you. I haven't been mentioning every single little donation I get here on Talking Metal. They're all greatly appreciated, but Jeff, you went above and beyond, so thanks for that. I don't take it for granted. The website, yeah. I don't know, Jeff. I've tried it on different computers, and I have noticed that lag that you're mentioning. And that sometimes, and other times I don't notice it. So the only time I do notice it is when I go to the address bar and type in, you know, www.talkingmetal.com. And sometimes it takes a little time to come up. Other times it doesn't. So I don't know what the deal is. I have seen the issue happen sometimes, so you're tipping me off, and I have reached back out to the girl in Alabama, and that was 3 days ago, and she hasn't responded, so I'm not sure. I might need somebody else to help me with the web work on this. We want you to be able to visit talkingmetal.com and not have any issues. One thing I could suggest is if you go to talkingmetal.com/digital, which is basically where talkingmetal.com redirects you, and you bookmark that in the meantime, there should be no problems or lag times with that. So, but yeah, no, it's a problem, dude. And any technical problems that people are having, we need to know about. So thank you for alerting us to this. And I know we went back and forth with the emails, and you were explaining what you were seeing on your PC. So hopefully we can get this fixed for you sooner than later. So I appreciate that, Jeff. And let's touch base in a week or two and see if it's resolved, okay? All right. So, Jeff, by the way, you wanted to hear a song. You emailed me about this. And let's get into that right now. And then we got to get into my interview with Carl, my discussion with Carl. Let's see. I have the song you requested. Devilment is the band. And the song is Full Dark, No Stars. I didn't really know these guys, so thank you for turning me on to them. Let's check them out right now on Talking Metal. And again, Jeff, thanks for your donation. Thanks for your note about a technical issue with talkingmetal.com. Here we go. A little Devilment as requested by Jeff. Thank you. We'll be right back.
chasing demons in my mind. I pitched into the dark, into the dark, into the dark. Who could have known they'd find me there? And in the depths of my despair, imprison me inside.
Get into the LA metal talk right now, okay? We're going to start things off with one of the definitive hard rock metal bands, and the earlier stuff to me definitely had a metal vibe. You know, anything with Warren DeMartini's guitar playing and, of course, the King, Robin Crosby's guitar playing too, they had a highly overdriven guitar sound, very good, great guitar sound. Both of them. I mean, not just Warren. I mean, Robin's sound was excellent and always gave it the band a metal edge. Judas Priest was an influence on this band, as well as, you know, Aerosmith and other great hard rock bands. The band I'm talking about is Rat. So let's get into some early Rat right now on Talking Metal. And then we're going to get into my interview with Carl Alvarez from the Inside Metal documentary series. This is a song called You Think You're Tough. Now, here's the deal with this song. It was on the Rat EP, which came out before the Out in the Cellar album. If you remember the Rat EP, it had a pair of sexy legs, which actually belonged to Tawny Katane, and had a bunch of rats crawling up the legs. And it's interesting because I had it like an alternate version of this EP, which had an additional song. It had You're in Trouble on it, which was then re-recorded for the Out of the Cellar release. And I believe it was re-recorded. I don't believe it was the same version that they used on Out of the Cellar. And it was called the Rat EP, and it just said You're in Trouble on the front. And I bought this, even though it didn't have the sexy legs on it, I bought it over the other version of the EP because it had this extra song, You're in Trouble, again, a song that was then re-released on Out of the Cellar. And that version, I think I have this right, the version of the album with the sexy legs on it did not have You're in Trouble. But both versions of the EP, if you're still following this, had Back for More, a different version of Back for More, which of course was, I believe, the second single off of Out of the Cellar. The Rad EP also had the cover Walking the Dog, an old blues song that Aerosmith had previously covered on their first record. So Rat did their own version of it on the Rat EP. The Rat EP was great. Sweet Cheater was such a good song. And just great stuff. So I highly recommend, if you don't know that early Rat EP, check it out. Good stuff. And yeah, so without further ado, let's do this. Let's check out You Think You're Tough. By Rat. I believe this is 1981, maybe 82, era Rat. So here you go. And then we're going to talk with Carl. Hey, this is Mark Striegel of Talking Metal, and with us today we have Carl Alvarez, who is one of the producers on the Inside Metal documentaries. Carl, welcome to Talking Metal.
Hi, Mark. I'm glad to be here on Talking Metal. It'll be an interesting show, so I really look forward to talking with Mark about the movie as well as what actually happened on the ground level, which is quite an experience. It's fun to talk about it because it's a good time. So I think we'll dive into some fun areas together.
Absolutely. You know, we had Bob Nalbandian on, who is one of the other producers on the documentary with us. He's been on twice, actually, and we've talked a lot about the stories that you actually cover in the documentary with Bob, and maybe we'll do some of that tonight. But I also want to talk to you just about the basic production of this thing, how you went about assembling it all. I mean, the amount of interviews you guys do is just staggering. I mean, it's really incredible. And it just, as somebody who does a podcast and somebody who works in television production, it seems like this was just a hell of a lot of work. What inspired the idea to do this? And that's question A. And question B is, did you realize how much work it was going to be when you came up with that idea?
Well, the simple story is Bob was approached by Joe Floyd, the guitarist of Warrior, who actually is a music producer too as well. And he has his hands in a lot of different things that he does in that world. He had been working with an executive producer named Warren Croyle on various projects, maybe throughout the years. They kind of had a kind of a business relationship. Right. There was a point where Bob had actually interviewed Joe Floyd about music producers for his podcast when Bob did his Shockwaves podcast. And he had a bunch of other different people there too, just talking about favorite metal producers and such. And kind of the question came up to Bob, because Joe, Warren had said, you know, hey, we want to do some type of thing on L.A., and the hard rock scene and the 80s and this sort of thing. So I think that it was kind of recent, and Joe had approached Bob kind of right around that time and kind of said, you know a lot of different people of that era, and I know a lot of different people from that era. Maybe we can do something here. And that's what kind of got the ball rolling. That was 2011 or 12, I can't remember. Okay. Yeah, 2012. So fast forward, Bob and I would actually kind of also were doing something on the side too with this Shockwaves. We kind of did a video cast. So we were kind of in that visual world together too, as well, just in a YouTube sense. But so kind of brought me on board to kind of just kind of assemble all this stuff together. You know, when you start on a journey, you don't know where the journey is going to take you, what's going to come up, these sorts of things. So kind of needed somebody to just kind of administratively put things together, whether it be simple editing or, you know, matching audio with video. That's kind of where I started in this whole project. And Bob felt like, okay, you know the material extremely well, you have a passion for this, and I just want to bring you in. Just as much as Bob has kind of been in the scene from this early era, he kind of had like a blueprint of what that was about, because he lived it. Right. Joe lived it too. He was kind of like maybe 5 years earlier than us, going from San Diego, where he came from, and coming up to LA and seeing Van Halen and, you know, play at the roller rink, you know, or these clubs that were kind of sprouting out in this early era of time, which there was certain clubs that were established and other clubs that were just kind of rolling clubs that maybe 6 months later they weren't there, or there'd be a different format. So Joe was out here too, kind of involved in that early part of the scene too. But he and his band Warrior too, they were part of the explosion of what we're talking about here with episode two. So he was a kind of an important part of this whole picture. And then me, you know, same time, same era. So we kind of joined forces and just kind of knew we had a vision. Bob had a vision. Joe had a vision. I had a vision, and we just kind of culminated together and really took. I don't think we really actually knew what it meant to put all this stuff together, because it's like you say, it's a lot of material. It started out maybe with 20 or 30 interviews, but it started to steamroll where, you know what, we need this person. Oh, we need to approach that person. We saw little holes that needed to be filled to really kind of embellish the story a little bit better. And, you know, when you get somebody like Stephen Parisi, who took a while for us to kind of get him, and luckily through a connection of ours, Gino Zamparelli reached out to him over and over. And finally he said yes. And it turned out to be a really good component to the whole thing, along with everybody else. I mean, I think everybody status-wise is on the same playing field, because this is really the kind of the pre-genesis or the genesis of the whole LA experience of what people in terms of the what people know or think about the Sunset Strip and the whole rock scene in LA. This is everybody's at that ground level telling their stories in the movie. So assembling all this, it was a lot of work. And we were kind of just amateurs trying to do professional work and, you know, and actually having these compelling stories too. So there was a lot of questions to these various artists. And then there was a lot of talking.
Right.
So just pulling out the bits and pieces, that was the hardest part, but we managed to do it.
How open were these people when you approached them, like a Don Dock? And I mean, I can't believe Lars Ulrich from Metallica, which is talks to nobody unless you're like a, you know, Rolling Stone or a major media outlet. I mean, how hard was it to get a guy like Lars Ulrich to do this?
Bob has had a relationship with Lars for many, many years. When Lars moved out here, Lars had an extensive British of new wave of British heavy metal collection. Word got to Bob, hey, this, I think through his friend Patrick Scott, they were kind of mutual buddies. And this is probably 80, maybe, if I can think way back then.
Right.
And they went over to his place over here at Park Newport, over here in Newport Beach, and saw what this guy had, which at that time, nobody had collections as that deep. And there was a lot of, you know, when you got imports, there were like $20 or right. $25. So that's pretty much like a month's worth of allowance, you know. So here's a guy nobody knows from Denmark, and he's got this outrageous collection. And of course, that started their friendship, you know, because the love of this British new wave of British heavy metal. So long story short, they've had an ongoing relationship since then, and I think Bob's on Lars' short list, basically. So right. You know, Bob asked for, you know, kind of this type of favor. Lars is pretty good about coming to the table, which is great, you know. And we all went up to the Metallica headquarters when this interview was conducted. That was October of 2012, I believe, or 2013. I can't remember. And it was a great experience in the sense that you got to see kind of behind the curtain of what Metallica is all about and just kind of ground zero of Metallica, basically, you know. And the staff was awesome. They're great. Bree, who is, you know, Lars' assistant, facilitated the whole interview. And basically, Lars just showed up. He actually was kind of running late that day, but he was very apologetic. And it was funny hearing him talk, as kind of was an hour interview, and he really kind of lit up in a big way, because I don't think anybody's really talked to him about this particular part of Metallica's career or even the scene so much, which is actually more of the story of what he's talking about, of how he started to get involved with the scene and meeting up with James and Ron McGovney and kind of this really innocent time for Metallica, you know, the progenitus of their beginning. So,
which was, of course, in L.A. I mean, a lot of people think of San Francisco when we hear Metallica, but Lars and James started in the Los Angeles area. And
that's right.
And moved up to San Francisco because Cliff was up there.
Yeah, that, as the story goes, yes, exactly. I think we touch on it a little bit. Actually, we're working on episode 3, which is the thrash era.
Right.
And Joey gets into that a little bit. And somebody else does talk about that too, about the whole seeing Cliff for the first time when Trauma played at the Troubadour with Bitch, October 8, 1982. And then the kind of courtship started between Lars and James and Cliff to, you know, get this guy in the band. We need him. So this, even before that though, when Metallica was trying to get a name for themselves or just even start really, you know, but they had big dreams. You can hear their big dreams even back then, trying to find Iron Maiden after a concert in 1982, going up to Hollywood, you know, and Lars just coming back from his lost summer vacation when he went to Europe to hang out with the Diamond Head guys and go to all the European festivals. So, you know, you see what it means for a person to really kind of manifest their dreams as innocent with rock and roll and metal. You know, it's pretty amazing. And, you know, Metallica is really still a people's band. They always will be a people's band. So it's really nice to get them in there. Whatever you could say about Metallica or Lars or whatever, you know, it kind of doesn't matter, because he's just like us, really, when he's talking about this beginning part. So it was really cool to have him, and it was actually an honor in that sense. Absolutely. But like I said, I think everybody, status-wise, we're all – I kind of just see it, everybody's kind of the same, because they're telling this beginning part in such a way that everybody was – didn't really have a name for themselves. We're trying to make a mark here.
Right. Quickly, you know, you mentioned the next episode, and we've been talking about Lars and Metallica. Can we expect, when can we expect episode 3, and is Lars a big part of episode 3?
Well, it's kind of, without jumping ahead, just enough to jump ahead. We expect it in 2017, kind of, we're starting 2017, so I can imagine it coming out by summertime.
Really? Okay, well, that's soon.
Maybe by fall at the latest.
Okay.
Depends how it kind of all comes together. But Lars plays a role in it, sure. You know, there's other players like Rocky George, David Ellison. We got a kind of a surprise person at the very end that came through that I can't tell you. But one of the bigger bands of the whole thrash scene. But, you know, that story really hasn't been told, and because it's really, you know, obviously San Francisco just took the baton, and L.A. doesn't really get recognized for its thrash roots. But, you know, if you think about it, Metallica started here in Orange County. I mean, thrash
Slayer,
metal.
Too. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Slayer. Slayer played the Woodstock in Anaheim in Orange County. So I think Orange County and Los Angeles is the birthplace of metal. I mean, you think of Dave Mustaine. He grew up out here in Costa Mesa and Huntington Beach. So OC guys, basically. And
right.
James is from Brea, so in Orange County. So, you know, it's an important part.
Now, let me ask you, as somebody who's from that area, you know, you mentioned Orange County, which is not the city of Los Angeles. Orange County is this county that what is south of Los Angeles, and I would call it more suburban. Do you agree with that?
Oh yeah, very much so.
Yeah, and in New York, where I'm from, I always felt that in the city of New York, and specifically the borough of Manhattan, you know, where Wall Street is and Times Square and all the hustle and bustle, metal never really thrived. At times it had some popularity there, but in the city of New York City, specifically Manhattan, it was always kind of frowned upon and never taken seriously. Yet it was in the suburbs, places like New Jersey, where Metallica came to sign with Megaforce, and even Queens and the outer boroughs, where metal really connected with people. You know, and even though we think of the Sunset Strip being, you know, thriving and being such an important place in the history of hard rock and heavy metal, is it safe to say that Orange County is like you said, possibly the true place of it, not the Sunset Strip?
Oh, if we're talking about thrash, I would...
Well, I'm talking about just hard rock, metal, thrash in general.
Oh, okay. So we'll go with that kind of mental thought, because I think you're on to something. Because I think the suburban kids were clamoring for something, and Orange County actually represented a little something different than the glitz of L.A. and Sunset Strip, which actually was kind of the... You know, I would probably say it was the ground zero for everything to come together.
Right.
But you have to think about it, too. All those early bands came from other places.
Yeah.
So we're talking Steeler. They came from Nashville. Motley Crue, although maybe three members were from Southern California. You have Nikki Sixx from San Jose, who migrated down here. The Rat Guys, they're all San Diego guys. Jakey right. Lee was San Diego. You know, George Lynch was from here. Randy Rhoads was from here. But there was a lot of guys that did come from other places, too. So, you know, I would say Sunset Strip was ground zero, for definitely, for sure. But these other areas really kind of had something different to offer, and the kids that were ready for metal were probably, they were more fans of the music. Not to say the LA fans weren't fans of the music, but there's a lot of other things going on, you know. There's a lot of people trying to impress with the clothes or the hair and that whole thing, where Orange County had a pure attitude and clubs were more on a pure level in terms of the music.
Right.
So I don't know if that kind of gives you kind of a polarity between those two worlds, which are very close together. And we can't really actually forget about these other areas, too, that are north of or east, like Pasadena, sure. which is east of – which is the Armored Saint guys, and Snow, early parts of Quiet Riot, or Burbank, where you actually have Randy Rhoads coming from Burbank. And that's in the eastern Valley, the San Fernando Valley. So it's just a combination of all of these kind of, like you say, boroughs. We have like areas, the Valley or Hollywood Central or Orange County. So it's kind of our borough system, if you will.
Definitely. And do you think there's like, what is the reason that this style of music, be it glam metal, you know, all the way through to thrash metal, really seem to connect with kids in the suburbs more so than urban city kids? Why do you think that is? Is it the working class? What is it?
Well, I'll go back to Orange County, and it there was, you know, during the Reagan era, it was this lot of talk about, the whole these bombs and the defense industry. We had a lot of that out here. Now, I make this connection between that as well as all the bands came, let's say, I'm going to jump ahead, you know, with thrash metal, you know, Downey, there was a defense contractor that was here, where Downey, you know, is a city that's kind of a suburb of Los Angeles. It's where Kerry King grew up. He went to Warren High School. The guys in Dark Angel, Dave Lombardo was from there, and the Stones Throw Away on the other side in Southgate, which is across the river. That's where Tom Araya was from. Right. So these kind of suburb areas just brought out a kind of a more pure thing. They didn't have to compete with the big hair or the cool clothes up in L.A. So again, coming from this pure aspect, I think Orange County kind of had that going for it. And there was also something, too, the authenticity of what was coming at that time that led up to the explosion. Lizzie Borden kind of says it really good in the movie about when they were kind of starting out and thinking that we can't be as big as Led Zeppelin, we can't be as big as this. But when they start to hear albums by Black Sabbath, you know, when Heaven and Hell comes out in 1980, it's like there's a power that's different from the 70s. And then you got a band like Def Leppard who comes out, 16-year-old, 17-year-old kids on a major label putting out this new wave of British heavy metal thing. And it makes a lot of the kids say, I can do that. I'm just like them. And I've been playing guitar too. And, you know, and I could save up for those Marshalls. And, you know, so that's kind of how the ball started rolling, really. Because that's what you started to see in the scene. You know, when we talk about the pioneers, their first episode, it was really predominantly a rock scene.
Yeah.
Regardless. Nobody called it metal. Nobody called it this or that. Maybe there was new wave, but that was a different beast. And that didn't associate with the rockers, much as the rockers didn't associate with them, as much as the punk rock people didn't associate with the rockers. Although there was a little bit early on where they were sharing the same stages, you know, when Van Halen, before Van Halen was signed, you know, they played with kind of these types of bands too. It's just kind of how the landscape was at that time. But it started to get more refined, and the kids were caught on to what that was about, especially, I believe, you know, I think Van Halen probably started it because right. they're a California band. But And then you saw a lot of bands that were doing kind of the Van Halen type trip, you know, the whole tapping and the whole Eddie Van Halen thing. But I think the new wave British heavy metal, along with the 70s artists, kind of infused everything together, you know, the Ted Nugents and the Aerosmiths and the UFOs, totally. And then you get the Black Sabbath and then the Judas Priest. So you could see the kind of this connection between where it started and where it was going in terms of the, even especially with the music industry.
Absolutely. So your first documentary was the Pioneer Inside Metal, the Pioneers of LA Rock and Metal. Now the second one that came out in, I guess it was 2016, the LA metal scene explodes. And you've mentioned you're working on the third one now, which is going to be thrash. But let's talk about this second one, which I enjoyed Pioneers of LA Rock and Metal a lot, but I loved what you guys did with the LA metal scene explodes, the second episode of Inside Metal. And, you know, there's so many great interviews and there's so many great little stories in there. Let's, in general terms, what year did the LA metal scene explode?
Well, I tend to talk about the lead up, which I kind of addressed. The scene really kind of started to take a metal sense in 81, 82.
Right.
But when it really exploded, Quiet Riot releasing Metal Health, the S Festival, Motley Crue, Shout at the Devil. I mean, that's kind of the three pinnacles, I guess, of boom, this is going down and this is happening. It was solidified. Those are the three events that solidified the explosion. Because thereafter, all those bands who got signed that were playing on the scene, that were competitive with one another, that were coming up, they got record deals. And that's where the explosion happened. So,
right on. Now, going back to Bob Nalbandian, you worked with him on Shockwaves. But where did you guys first meet? Where did you first encounter Bob?
Oh, Bob, I think we met in the 90s, but we actually were probably at a lot of the same shows together and didn't know one another. So we were kind of in this parallel universe, I guess. But I didn't get to know Bob until like the 90s, really. And I mean, he lived in Huntington Beach, and I moved to Huntington Beach in the 90s. So I think it was kind of a natural thing where, hey, you like metal? I like metal too. Cool. Let's hang out.
You
know, and we kind of knew some of the same people too. This is before Facebook, where you could see all, you know, it was like, oh, you know that person? Okay. So we kind of had a mutual admiration for what metal was about. And,
Did you meet at a certain show or through a friend?
No, I think it was a friend of ours, Sean Baruch, who actually sang for an 80s band called Titan. They were on Restless Records in the 80s, kind of a little notoriety. But it was through him. And then we just became fast friends. So, yeah.
Out of all the stars and bands you've interviewed for the documentary so far, I mean, from Metallica to Great White, Armored Saint, Rat, you mentioned Stephen Piercy. Don Dokken has some great lines in both documentaries he's in. Who were you the most starstruck with?
Wow, that's really hard to say. You know, I'll pick two different people out. One would be Stephen Piercy, for obvious reasons. I like Stephen Piercy for this notable matter, and the next person I'm going to mention for the same notable matter, but for a different trajectory in terms of their career. But let's start with Piercy. He came out here with nothing, and he starved, scratched everything he could do when he had his band Mickey Rat, and they just couldn't get a break in Los Angeles. And of course, New Wave was starting to come on strong, and punk rock, and they were fighting to make that rock thing happen. And I think when they came, when things really kind of to show themselves for Rat, it was 82 when Warren DeMartini came into the whole picture, really kind of changed the sound. But there was a lot of influx too. Like, they didn't have a lot of money and they were sleeping in people's cars, and it was just kind of that thing, you know? So hearing this kind of bare bones story And then, you know, just knowing his career and where it went, it's pretty amazing. And so in that sense, I think Piercy is actually a really cool guy. He probably puts a front on himself.
Right.
You know, he's a real dude, you know, and that's what I liked about him. The other person I was going to mention was Richard Black from Shark Island, who really were getting into the last phase of the whole Sunset Strip bands getting signed. They got signed to Epic and Epic Records in 88, and their record came out in 89. But They had a rough road, too. They started out as the Sharks, and we can actually even go earlier. He was part of the whole Pioneers experience, too, with his band Pretty Poison. And they were also from the Pasadena, the East San Gabriel Valley. They were out that way, too. So they were one of those types of bands, too. But I find Richard Black kind of an interesting person, an interesting take on the scene. He's kind of insular in terms of how he went about it and who he aligned himself with and who he didn't align himself with. Right. And probably there's more people he wouldn't align himself with. They were kind of in their own boat and trying to chart these waters of where they wanted to take their music. And you know, it's unfortunate for them. They kind of got the tail end of what the 80s were. They were a great band, though. Really great band.
And they had quite a history before they were signed, right? Like they even though they, you know, I always felt like there were certain bands that got signed late, and to the, you know, general public, the record buying, you know, consumer throughout the country, people like me, for example, were like, oh, well, they're third generation LA metal. They're no good. They're clones. They're, you know, but yet some of these bands, it took them that long to get signed, and they were doing it for a long time. Is that true with Shark?
Oh, with the Sharks, when they were the Sharks, and then when they turned into Shark Island, which was probably 86, maybe 87.
Right.
So yeah, long road for them. But you know, they did it their way. They didn't copycat. They had their own thing, and that's one of the things we brought up out of many things with Shark Island. You know, the whole Richard Black, Axl Rose, who's doing who and who's doing what, you know. And
right.
You could say the jury's still out on that, or he tells his story, and you know, it's a lot of that, kind of a lot of that going on in Los Angeles, I guess, you know, at that time. So, cool. But those are two people, if you're asking me. I think those, not in terms of starstruck, but really kind of like their rich history, I guess.
Yeah. Definitely cool. Well, the documentaries, plural, is again called Inside Metal. Just a great watch. I watched it on Amazon Prime. It is also available on DVD. Where is the best place the Talking Metal listeners can pick up the DVD?
Well, I would probably say Amazon. There's also, we have our Metal Rock Films, which is the executive producer. It's a PayPal situation. You can get it there, but I'm not sure how much it is. I think it might be a little bit cheaper than going to Amazon, but again, you have to have PayPal.
By the way, I'm on Amazon right now, and the first one, Pioneers of LA Rock and Metal, it's saying temporarily out of stock.
Yeah, you know, they have a revolving inventory. It just, you know, don't let that kind of stop you from buying it.
The LA know? Metal Scene Explodes, the second one, which is my favorite of the two, that is in stock. Cheap, too, $9.89.
Oh, yeah, perfect. Yeah, so, you know, there's not too many people, and I think that's why we came to the table of doing something like this. There was nobody coming forward and really telling the story. You know, a lot of people put their toe in the water and kind of do a kind of a broad stroke on the whole thing. We actually went in intensively and put this thing together. If you were there in 1982, 1983, boots on the ground, that's what you have seen. You know, no question, by just hearing the stories in the movie. And that's, we really kind of felt like we accomplished a lot in terms of really, because we tried to explain, you know, if you tried to explain the scene to people that weren't there, maybe they have their own imagination of what it was like. But a lot of people just made up their mind on what that is. And that's not exactly correct. So
right.
Having this kind of really present itself in the same manner, but in a really kind of more deep in a fan way, that was really important for us to kind of get across, and we definitely did. And
absolutely.
It's so in terms of that, and in terms of historical significance of the scene, you know, I mean, I could sell it all day if I wanted to, but see it for yourself. This is really kind of how it went down, and these are the people that were there, ground zero. So,
right on. And we are, of course, talking about Inside Metal. The LA metal scene explodes is episode 2, guys. It's a great watch. We're going to have it linked through today's show notes on talkingmetal.com. Definitely do yourself a favor and watch this. It's also on Amazon Prime, which if you do the Amazon Prime streaming thing, you can watch it there. It looks great. Sounds great. Carl, it's been great talking with you today.
Oh, yeah. Very good, Mark. And definitely appreciate your time, and definitely check it out. And we appreciate all your whatever you're doing. We appreciate you guys in the community and what you're doing, Mark. It's very important to keep this music and this kind of attitude and everything that goes with it alive. So thank you very much.
Big thanks for joining us, Carl, on this episode of Talking Metal. We're going to have Carl on the very next episode, and I love what he does on the next episode. He runs down like 5 like kind of cool behind the scenes moments he experienced kind of growing up in the LA club scene, and share some very cool stories. I you know, not that this interview that we had on this episode with Carl wasn't good, because it was, but I think he really, in this next episode that we're going to have him do this top 5 list, really is, it's really good. It's really good. So definitely come back. And we actually may have a very significant figure from the LA metal scene on the next episode too, a guy that we spoke about during the interview. I haven't interviewed him yet, so I don't like to jinx it, but I'm supposed to interview him on Tuesday night. So hopefully we'll have Carl back on the next episode. And also hopefully Stephen Piercy from Rat. We'll see. All right. So having said that, let's wrap things up with some more music. This is Hollywood Rose featuring, of course, Axl, pre-Guns N' Roses. This is Killing Time, a little early LA hard rock and metal here on Talking Metal.
guys, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast. Again, go visit talkingmetal.com. You know, speaking of LA metal guys, Tommy Lee made an appearance on my Snapchat feed in the studio with Andrew Watt, the great New York young, he's got to be under 30, guitar player Andrew Watt, who played on California Breed with Glenn Hughes and Jason Bonham, and he had a good EP out last year that had some great, like, pop, I call them pop rock with a guitar edge songs that not a lot of people noticed. He also plays, and I think they're called Heavy Chevy, I think, with Taylor from the Foo Fighters. He has a band with him. So Andrew Watt, yeah, and Tommy Lee spotted in the studio doing some recording for who knows what, but I'm very curious because I love Andrew Watt and I love Tommy Lee, and can't wait to hear whatever they're cooking up. And it was interesting because Tommy, you know, he didn't have the big double bass crazy kit in the studio. It was more like a stripped down simple kit that he was playing that, you know, when Andrew shot him on Snapchat. So at Snapchat's pretty pretty crazy thing if you haven't experienced it yet. I am starting to dig it, and Andrew Watt is constantly posting stuff on Snapchat, so be sure to check him out. And on that note, I probably should go into some Motley Crue, but instead I'm going to play Wasp. Love this song. Fuck Like the Beast, little LA metal, early LA metal here on Talking Metal with the one and only Wasp. Catch you next time, guys.